Accession number 28637, Reel 5.
Mrs. Alison Selford, Reel 5.
Right. So I knew everybody was going to vote Labour at the end of the war, and I quite understood why. And a lot of it, though people didn't quite put it this way, that they realised a lot of their sufferings during the slump had been totally unnecessary. Suddenly the war started and there was enough to go round for everybody. For the first time, the children of the working classes were getting enough to eat. And suddenly there was work for everybody and there were wages for everybody. And that could all have been organised before the war if the government had thought of it. This was people's view anyway. And they felt, looking back on the awful things that had happened during the slump, it had all been completely unnecessary. And it was all the fault of the Tories, they felt. And they weren't voting for a Tory government, not even to please Mr. Churchill. So I expressed this view forcibly when a communist leader called Emil Burns came to the Daily Worker office and tried to sell us this line about we'd got to work for a continuation of the wartime coalition to go on after the war. And I said, no, we haven't. Everybody wants a Labour government. And Emil Burns said, oh, really, you've been talking to a few shop stewards. And I was furious with Emil Burns, a ghastly little man. But anyway, my line triumphed, not because Stalin was convinced by my arguments or indeed ever heard of them, but because the Labour Party said it wasn't staying in the wartime coalition, it was coming right out of it as soon as the war in Europe was over, which happened at once, instantly. As soon as the war in Europe was over, they didn't wait for the end of the war with Japan. They said they were coming out of the wartime coalition and were standing as a part, so there had to be an election. The election, funny how I remember the exact date, the election took place on July the 5th, 1945. We were still at war with Japan, as I say, but we'd had the rejoicings and the dancing in the streets for the victory in Europe. And I quite understood why Churchill thought he was absolutely bound to win. How could anybody forget what he'd done in the war? Well, they hadn't forgotten it. I actually saw Churchill campaigning. I was in Hackney when Churchill drove past slowly in an open car, standing up and waving to the crowd. And everybody politely cheered, and I cheered too, because after all, he had won the war. We were very grateful to him. But they were all going to vote Labour. I knew that. Churchill didn't. And couldn't understand how deeply and bitterly people hated all his Conservative colleagues. And so we didn't have the result. The general election, as I say, took place July the 5th. We didn't get the result until July the 26th because the soldiers had votes and they were overseas and the votes had to be brought back and counted. And so it was 3 weeks before we knew the result. And when we knew the result, and it was an overwhelming Labour landslide, It was marvellous walking about the streets of London that day. The people were so happy. I remember shouting to two workmen who were carrying a glass plate, a glass window. They were doing some repairs. I said, "Labour's in." And they were so thrilled they almost dropped the glass. Somewhere, I forget what I was doing that day and why I was travelling about London, but for some reason I fetched up in Islington and somebody said happily, "We got Thelma Cazalet out." I thought of this years later when I met Thelma Cazalet, a nice, sweet lady. Pity she should be tarred with the same brush as her fellow Tories, whom she had so often fought on all sorts of issues. But there, they got her out, and it was a terrific, absolutely marvellous day. Complete surprise for the Tory press, but as I say, not for me.
How about the communists? Did any communists stand in that
election?
Oh,
yes. Oh, yes, that was very interesting. We had a communist candidate in Hornsey called G.J. Jones. What the G and the J stood for, I never know. He was always known as Jonah to his friends. But Jonah got 10,000 votes. He didn't get in. Afterwards, it became clear he had only got the 10,000 votes because people were a bit confused and a lot of people thought he was the Labour candidate. But, I mean, nobody ever dared say that. But one chap got in, and that was Phil Paratin. Phil Paratin was a nice man. He was living proof that about Arthur Koestler's theory about some of the Jews are Mongols, really. Do you know that one? Yeah. He looked Mongolian. And he did not look Jewish. He looked from the Far East. He was a charming man, sweet and clever and delightful, and another one who would obviously have been at a university if things had been different for him. And he got in because his part of the East End, he stood for Mile End, and I went along to one of his meetings. He addressed the Tailor and Garment Workers Union, and they also had the Labour man along who was the sitting MP there. I mean, it was just between Communist and Labour. Nobody was going to vote Tory in my land. And Phil Paratin gave the most wonderful, lively, enthusiastic speech about all the things that could be done for the people and all the possibilities that were open before him. A real good speech. And then because this was a time of great hope. People felt everything was in their power. If they defeated Germany, what couldn't they do? And then the Labour man, who wouldn't appear on the same platform as Phil Paratin, but he came in afterwards, and he gave a grudging, miserable type speech. "How dare you talk to Phil Paratin," was the main burden of it. And obviously nobody was going to vote for him. And when he'd gone, somebody said the only time he opened his mouth in Parliament was to ask the Speaker to open the window. It turned out he was known as the local drunk. I forget his name. But Anyway, he was no good. Clearly felt Bratton was a good guy, and he got in with only 5,000 votes because there were so few people left alive in Mile End.
Well, what was the official view of that election result, you know, bearing in mind that Stalin had wanted something different?
Oh, Stalin forgot all about having wanted something different, of course. Stalin knew knew when to forget his own directives. But the fascinating thing was, of course, the fact that apart from Phil Paratin and apart from the communist in Scotland, old Gallagher, Gallagher had been an MP since 1935, so there were these two communist MPs in the House, and apart from that, all the communists got fairly small votes. Bill Rust got, I think, 5,000 in South Hackney. Bill Rust thought so highly of me at this time that he said I was to report his campaign in South Hackney, which I did. Mrs. Rust, Tamara Rust, looked at me with a basilisk eye, and I have never discovered to this day, I do not know how one can approach a lady in her situation and say, you've got nothing to worry about. I am not one of your husband's mistresses. It's a very difficult and tricky thing to do. So anyway, she always disliked me intensely, but with no reason, at least as far as Bill Rust was concerned, she had no reason to. He was a most awful-looking man. I don't know why anybody would go with him, but there they did. But
the sort of high hopes with the Labour Party, which was very left at that time, wasn't it?
We thought that there were a lot of left-wing MPs. I mean, people like Tom Dryburgh, who was a communist spy actually, but we didn't know that. We were very puzzled why we had to support Tom Dryburgh, considering that he was a notorious homosexual, and the party was supposed not to approve of that.
But goodness, you were told to support him, were you? Mm-hmm. You were told that you had to support him.
Oh, it definitely, the word went out we were supporting Tom Dryburgh, and it was quite embarrassing sometimes. He got run in, but it was all hushed up. And there was he was arrested somewhere for soliciting boys. And then there was
Connie Zyliakis was another one, wasn't he?
Oh, Connie Zyliakis was another left-winger we had to support. Of course, we all loved him dearly, but he was quite a decent guy. Come 1956, he gave a speech, which I think I mentioned in my book, denouncing the Russian invasion of Hungary. I heard him give it at Unity Theatre. Good gracious. At this point, of course, I'd fallen in love again. It was a habit I had. And the object of my affections was an incredibly beautiful black chap from Canada, a Canadian soldier. And there weren't many Canadian soldiers who were black. He wasn't solid black, so to speak. He was mixed. Anyway, I was madly in love with him. That was my first husband, much disapproved of by my family. And then he deserted me before my baby was even born, so he never saw her. So he was a dead loss. So at this point, Jack Silford came back from the army, and his girlfriend threw him over, and he fell in love with my little brown baby, who was of such beauty that everyone fell in love with her. She was an absolutely gorgeous baby. Of course, I couldn't work full time with a baby, but I went back to work when she was still quite small, working the evening shift. And this was possible because Jack took would come back from a teaching. He'd become an emergency trained teacher. The war brought wonderful opportunities to all sorts of people. And really what he had always wanted to be was a teacher. And when he had been struggling to be a shopkeeper, this was what he dreamed of as the really happy life. And he loved being a teacher. So he used to come back from work early and look after little Catherine. And I would go on the night shift at the Daily Worker as a sub-editor. You see, I had to work in the office because when you have a baby, you have to have regular hours. You can't go wandering around the country. So it was... So we settled down very happily, Jack and I, and we were married for over 50 years. And
how did you find people reacted when you had a brown baby in that era?
Oh, well, the Communist Party was all for it, of course, but she was so beautiful that she... she disarmed people's opposition to brown babies in general. She was a sort of delicious brown.
Well, that's good to hear that she was accepted. The other thing I should have asked you, during the war, was the Second Front a big issue with the Daily Worker?
Oh, yes, terrific. Yes, we were always... before I joined the Daily Worker, we had a big meeting in Bristol, you see, and we were discussing the slogans. What were we going to put on the banners? So I suggested our slogan should be Two Fronts, One Fight. So the party took this up, and it became a general national slogan, Two Fronts, One Fight. And of course, the people said, well, you won't be on the beaches on that day. But in fact, a lot of our comrades were. A dear friend, as he afterwards became, I didn't know him then, Alec Bernstein, who became known as the novelist Alexander Baron, was one of the first on the beaches on that day, and he wrote a marvellous book about it, From the City, From the Plough, which is the description of his war experiences. He wrote it when he was recovering from a breakdown at the end of the war. He broke down completely. He was bilingual because he had a lot of relations in France. And for some time while he was ill, he could speak only in French. And when he told me this, I said, well, naturally, military orders were given in English. So you would react by talking only French. But anyway, as therapy, he wrote it all down, you see, and that's this marvellous book, From the City, From the Plough, which I'm happy to say was a bestseller and was never out of print, I think, till the end of his life, until it did go out of print and then somebody brought out a new paperback of it. so it was in print again.
Was there a lot, though, because I remember Stalin was pushing for the second
part. Oh, yes, Stalin was pushing for it, that's right.
So did the Daily Worker take up that?
Oh, God, good God, yes. Oh, the Daily Worker's all... It was all campaigning for the Second Front. As I say, there was a good deal said, are the people campaigning for it going to take part in it? But I must say in favour of the communists, though I no longer want to say very much in favour of the communists, but that I do say, they were perfectly ready to take part in it.
Of course, after the war came the Cold War, didn't it?
Well, the war came the Cold War, and we kept on trying to believe that anything the Russians did was right. It got harder and harder. And the...
What were the sort of turning points, do you think?
Oh, the turning point came... with Stalin's anti-Semitism, which at first we couldn't believe was really happening. And then there was the arrest of the Jewish doctors, so we'd got to believe it, hadn't we? But that's in my book. The turning points are listed in my book, because when I started writing this book, I went back at the notes I'd taken. I had a dear friend called Dora Scarlett, a lovely lady, and she was a passionate communist, and she went to work in Hungary for the Hungary. Budapest after the war was the centre of the radio, a communist radio effort to Western countries. And she worked on the broadcasts to England. And she was totally disillusioned by what she saw in Hungary. And came back after the Hungarian Rising in 1956. She came back penniless because she'd had to leave everything behind. And started writing a book. And when I was introduced and read the first draft of her book, I said, no, you've got the order of events wrong. We didn't know this then, we didn't know it until after we knew that. And I brought out the notes I had made of Daily Worker meetings. I'd made notes at the time because Jack wanted to know what the hell was going on, and I would come back and discuss it with him. And So I then typed out all these notes for Dora's benefit. That's the basis of this book. But it's very funny how you cannot remember how much you knew at any given time until you check up. Did I really think this? Did I really think that? You wonder. Or did you half think it? This is another thing. And long before we were totally disillusioned, Jack and I knew about a Dutchman called George Fless. He had been married to a girl called Pearl Rimmel. And the Rimmels were a passionate communist family. Several of their sisters were passionate communists and remained so. Pearl Rimmel and George Fless went to Russia together. She got pregnant. This all happened in the 1930s. She got pregnant, so she came back to England because they might be keen Stalinists, but they had noticed that Russia was no place to have a baby in. So she came back. While she was back in England, George Fless was arrested and never seen again. And It wasn't until a great nephew of his, he was a Dutch comrade, a great nephew of his tried to find out what had happened to him and that got hold of the archives, that we knew anything at all about George Flesch's interrogation. And we knew that George Flesch had disappeared in Russia. We knew he'd been arrested and never seen again. So why weren't we disillusioned if we knew that? It was...
Is it the fact that, you know, you sort of... You give so much, you've given so much, that it's very difficult to give up.
Oh, well, certainly. Yes. Indeed. And quarrel with members of your family about it. I mean, for years and years, Rebecca West and I weren't speaking. Of course, my daughters take the view this was no loss. My daughters couldn't stand her.
End of reel 5, Mrs. Alison Selford. Mrs. Alison Selford, reel 6. We will be finishing on this reel, you'll be pleased to hear. But it would be very interesting, you know, to ask you a little more about, you know, when you really decided to cut with the party. But you were saying about your Aunt Rebecca West and your relations with her.
Oh, yes, well, that was all part of the being in the Communist Party, and of course Rebecca West was a famous anti-communist by this time. Not in the 1930s. In the 1930s, she spoke at Popular Front meetings. But after the war, she was a famous anti-communist. And we weren't talking. And then... there were all the people one had quarrelled with. One thought, one leaves them, by the wayside, they don't understand the great communist ideal and all that. But disillusion did not set in until, as I say, Stalin arrested the Jewish doctors. And then Stalin died and the Jewish doctors were released. And Jack said, well, perhaps we had better not talk about our great leader for a little while.
Then, of course, you had the Khrushchev secret speech, didn't you?
But that was not until 1956. All sorts of strange and peculiar things happened before that, and they were I had a friend who was in Russia when Beria was arrested, which happened quite soon after Stalin's death, and he was on a train. My friend speaks quite fluent Russian. He was on a train and he went up and down the train trying to find somebody who would talk about the arrest of Beria. Not a soul. And people were still totally unaware how much it was safe to say. That was later months of 1953. You could only go... By the way, why hadn't I been to Russia after that occasion when I tried to go and it wasn't possible because the war would have broken out? Well, why didn't I go to Russia and find things out for myself long ere this? Because not only during the war, but for many years after the war, you couldn't go there unless by invitation. Delegations were invited.